You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 6.5 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Monday, December the 24th. Merry Christmas Eve. I'm filling in for Kathleen Dunn this hour for All Things Political, where each week at this time, Kathleen and her guests will talk about the biggest stories going on in national politics, kind of reviewing the past week on the national political scene and looking ahead for the week to come. And we welcome your observations from the news last week or this, what you want this week. In fact, since it's the day before Christmas, maybe we can play around a little bit here. What do you want from your national lawmakers for Christmas? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We are happy to have with us Ed Miller, Professor of Political Science at UW-Stevens Point. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So what do you want from your national lawmakers for Christmas?
Well, I don't know. there's a lot left on the agenda.
There is a lot left on the agenda. Let's talk about what was accomplished last week. We got an energy bill out of them last week, huh?
We did. And in the energy bill, it raised for the first time in many years the CAFE standards, or the average miles per gallon that cars must get. Now, that isn't for a while, but basically John Dingell, who was the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, who represents Detroit. Actually, he's represented Detroit for many years. He's the longest-serving member of the Congress, and his father represented that district before him. He was always opposed to that because of his Detroit constituency, but he basically told them, look, they're going to have to accept increased standards, and they did, yeah. And that's in the bill.
Does that surprise you at all that we are increasing these CAFE standards?
Well, it doesn't surprise me, but apparently the car companies have been pretty much against it. Mm-hmm. They have argued a lot of things, including the technology hasn't caught up with standards and other kinds of arguments like that. On the other hand, there are certainly more hybrid cars out there and other kinds of technology which are getting far more than the average car today.
Yeah. Now, there are some who are saying, well, maybe getting 35 miles per gallon by 2020 is a long time from now. We could do that sooner?
We should be able to. It would seem that way. In Europe, and we're beginning to get some in the United States, some smaller cars that get a lot more gas mileage just simply because they're smaller and they weigh less, especially for people who are using their car mainly for commuting within a city.
Yeah. We did hear, though, U.S. Representative Paul Ryan from the 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville and the GM plant, concerned about what this might do with regard to jobs?
Well, they're always concerned. I don't think that's going to have any effect on jobs. I think actually not doing it would have more of effect on jobs because Japanese automobile manufacturers are going to do it. And they've been way ahead of U.S. manufacturers, not only in that area, but in a variety of other areas. And that's why sales of U.S. cars have declined. And I think also U.S. automobile manufacturers have recognized that they'll need to do this if they are going to remain competitive. Because if gasoline is going to be above $3 a gallon, people are going to look for certainly more cost-efficient cars.
Yeah. The other thing this energy bill does, though, will increase the use of ethanol as well by around 2020.
Right, and that's an interesting issue, the whole question of ethanol. Mm-hmm. We have been relying in the United States more on this corn ethanol, mm-hmm. And which has raised corn prices. But now there's concern about that, both in terms of the prices, or whether that is the most efficient ethanol, which it isn't. And so even the president the other day said in his press conference that we would be moving more to some of the other kinds of ethanol than corn ethanol. But the idea is to use something other than oil, especially imported oil, and corn, you know, anything that we grow here, obviously is a renewable source of energy, and that's a possibility. Yeah. Also, other things such as wind power and those areas are being emphasized.
All right. Well, so that's one thing that happened with Congress and the president last week. We have this energy bill. I'm looking at some of these other stories from last week. The House sends an alternative minimum tax fix to the president. The House has sent President Bush a bill that protects taxpayers from the alternative minimum tax. So what can you tell us about this?
Right. Well, that's a very crucial aspect, because it goes back to 1969, and in 69, people were very much concerned, as probably they are today, and that is millionaires who were not paying any taxes. They were able to get out of taxes through various deductions and credits and things that were not taxed, such as municipal bonds, federally taxed municipal bonds. And so what they introduced was an alternative minimum tax. And if you reach certain criteria, you would have this alternative set of rules in which you would then calculate your tax. Well, that has never been changed. The income figures were never changed on that particular tax. You get to the point that today, with 2007, lots of people are falling into this alternative minimum tax that it was never intended to apply to. And so consequently, you know, people are concerned that all these middle-income taxpayers are not getting these deductions which were intended for them. Last year, there was an increased number, and it would be a substantial number increasing for paying their taxes for 2007, you know, which you would pay in 2008. And so there was been a great push to fix this alternative minimum tax, and the president was behind it, the Congress was behind it, but the question was what else was going to be in that bill. And finally, they got a fix, at least a temporary fix, of the alternative minimum tax. Some people wanted to get rid of it, but a temporary fix that raises the level for this year. The negative of that was when it was done, at least for the moment, it was done so late that the Internal Revenue Service will take quite some time to get their computers re-geared for that. And as a result, particularly those who are expecting tax returns and apply and file their taxes early in January, which I can't imagine people doing, but that's amazing. But anyway, people do file it in January, but they will not get their tax, they will not get tax refunds for at least 8 weeks more than they anticipated.
Yeah. The House is putting its stamp of approval on a $516 billion spending measure that funds 14 cabinet agencies and troop operations in Afghanistan. This year-end proposal that passed last week generally goes along with President Bush's budget, though it shifts billions of dollars into politically sensitive programs that the president sought to cut. Democrats added funding for food programs, subsidies to community development banks, Homeland Security Department grants, and other items. The White House has signaled that President Bush will sign this measure, which awards a 4% increase on average to domestic programs, but his approval depends on Senate Republicans succeeding in adding up to $40 billion for U.S. troops in Iraq. I see here that the House did approve $70 billion more for the war in Iraq.
Right.
Did the Senate do what the president wanted to?
Right. He will sign that bill. That's been a disaster the whole year, of course. That's the U.S. budget. And the U.S. budget doesn't come as a single budget like Wisconsin's budget does. U.S. budget normally comes, I should say, in there are 12 different budgets. And so they all actually, I believe all of them passed the House. So under Dave Obie, of course, he's the chair of the major committee, and they did get through the House, but in the Senate, that they had problems, because in the Senate, of course, you can filibuster bills, and you need 60 votes. So there's a problem in the Senate, but the other thing is that the president has vetoed some appropriation bills this year because they had the date of withdrawal from Iraq, and so he was opposed to that particular date. So that was one of the issues, and there were many other issues. And so even though the fiscal year started October 1st, we did not get a budget. And that was being delayed. It was they used continuing resolutions, which basically says it's a temporary spending measure. And finally, what they did was they took all these budgets and they stuck them together in what's often called an omnibus budget, or essentially they stuck them all together. And they passed it, and the president threatened to veto it unless they took out certain measures. And they basically acceded to the president's wishes. They did add some material, some money for domestic programs, because the president had cut substantially a lot of domestic programs to try to get the budget down because the international spending is so great. And but they did add some money back. However, there is an interesting story of this, that there were earmarks added to that bill.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, and actually there were more, I saw a story that said there were more Republican earmarks than Democratic earmarks, which is surprising.
Those tax and spend Republicans.
Right, given the Republican, given the president's criticism of the Democrats mm-hmm. adding the earmarks, there were more Republican earmarks in the bill. However, interestingly, apparently a number of those earmarks were not actually in the bill, but they were in the report to the bill. Basically, in that report, Congress, whenever it passes a bill, there's also a report that comes along with the bill. And those earmarks basically directing spending in the report. Well, reports technically are not law, but they usually are followed by the administration. The president has indicated that a lot of those earmarks in the bill will only be considered as wish lists, and he will not necessarily honor those particular earmarks, which is an interesting happening from those. So if they were actually in the bill, I mean, at least law says he must spend the money. But if it's in the report, which apparently a substantial number of them are actually in the report, but if they're in the report, the president's going to say, gee, you know, I'm just not going to spend that money, which is another interesting executive-legislative conflict which will take place.
We're talking with Ed Miller, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. It's All Things Political, recapping all the major news from Washington from last week. I'm Joy Cardine in for Kathleen Dunn, and looking forward to hearing from you this hour. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We welcome your observations from the news in the past week, or what you hope to see lawmakers accomplish in the weeks to come, national lawmakers. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. 20 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Monday, December the 24th, Christmas Eve. Coming up later today, a tradition, except Larry Mueller won't be here because Larry Mueller came down with the flu or something. We're sorry you're sick, Larry, and take care. But Santa Claus isn't sick. Santa Claus is still coming in, and I think Larry's little helper, Cheryl Gasser, will be in for him talking with Santa Claus. After 11 o'clock this morning, Santa will be taking children's calls until 12:30 about what kids want for Christmas this year. That's coming up after 11. We're talking about all things political, reviewing the news of the week from Washington with our guest, Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point. And our first caller is Alex in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning to the guest. I'm very thankful that I have a prehistoric transistor radio that operates with batteries so I can listen to Wisconsin Public Radio today. Thanks for being on.
Well, good morning, Alex.
I have a hypothesis about spending. On one side, we have tax and spend Democrats. On the other side, it's borrow and spend Republicans. But Mayor Quimby on The Simpsons had a great remark about his electorate. You know, he asked, you know, who are these morons? They want full services, but they want low taxes. And you know, we love our pork. We love our earmarks. We love our representative bringing home the bacon. I mean, that's who we are. I mean, even under Governor Thompson, I mean, the state increased, what, 200% in size? I mean, it just goes on and on. And I know that individuals like Grover Norquist has this idea of, you know, strangling the government in a bathtub or something. But, you know, in general, I don't think the people want what Grover Norquist and others who advocate that position are selling. And I'll listen on the radio. And thanks again for being on today.
Well, thanks, Alex. I'm glad you got that transistor radio.
Well, yeah, that's good. The old technology still works, but the that's always been the case, that people want various programs, but they don't want to tax, and you get to the point that that's pretty difficult. He mentioned Wisconsin, and Wisconsin has a particular problem in this area because you know, we have. Historically, Wisconsin has been a progressive state with a lot of services, and people actually move to Wisconsin because of the services. But on the other hand, we've been under basically a no-tax increase pledge, I guess, for quite a number of years now. And as a result, you get to the point that services have to be cut. And so with the U.S. government as well. If you look at the earmarks in particular, although there's some earmarks that may look laughable or various things for various districts, many of the earmarks actually are important for the districts. They're just not fluff. I mean, true that they were aimed at a particular district, but there are various things that are needed in that particular district. We, for example, had an earmark for the nursing program in Wausau at the technical college there. OB, that was part of an earmark. Central Wisconsin Airport, for example, the tower was an earmark. There was highways in Wisconsin that were in the Appleton area that were earmarks. These are all things that Wisconsin needed, and other states may say, gee, you know, you have powerful congressmen in Wisconsin, so you're getting these earmarks. And so, you know, these earmarks, but the people don't want to increase taxes, and it's very difficult to do. So what happens is a lot of governments, I mean, state governments, local governments, as well as the federal government, try to put taxes in an invisible way, that people pay the taxes without actually seeing the taxes, with various fees and other kinds of things that are not seen.
Yeah, I mean, and we want those earmarks, because those are good earmarks. They're our earmarks. They're not bridges to nowhere.
That's right. That's right. And there are some of those bridges to nowhere out there that may be some questionable.
Yeah. Julia in Wanakee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Good morning.
I was just wondering when the Democratic senators are going to learn to go on the news and start yelling about an up or down vote.
Yeah, about what?
Well, about anything. It just seems to be quietly accepted that you need 60 votes to get anything through the Senate these days. You know, prior to the 2006 elections, any time the Democrats whispered about filibustering something, there was just, you know, tut-tutting and oh, the Democrats aren't being bipartisan, and maybe we should have a nuclear option. And then once the Democrats had this tiny little majority, all discussion of how evil filibusters were just kind of went out the window, and it's assumed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, right. Actually, the original discussion of the filibuster and the so-called nuclear option had to do with voting on appointments and not necessarily on bills. But what you say is absolutely correct. If you look back in the old days, probably the days that Alex had his radio made. But if you look back those days, the fact is the filibuster was rarely done. It was sort of the weapon that was used, if you remember or read history, it was used like in civil rights, 1957, 1964 were some famous filibusters. But now it's not an exceptional weapon, but one that is used on every bill. And so the only way to get a bill up is to invoke cloture, which is cutting off debate, and that requires 60 votes. And that's been a major plug in the system. You can get something past the Senate, past the House, because the House only requires a majority vote, and then you get to the Senate, and things are stopped. And that was because of the 60 votes, and the Democrats do not have the 60 votes. So the goal in the next election, of course, besides winning the presidency of the Democrats, is to try to get over 60 votes in the Senate. And that way, issues can get through. Or some change in the rules. There are certain areas where you cannot filibuster. Currently, certain budgetary matters that are precluded in the rules. But other than that, as I say, the filibuster is the way it is done in the Senate, which has significantly reduced policy.
Yeah, Professor Miller, is it just me, or does it seem that President Bush is getting pretty much what he wants from this democratically controlled Congress?
No, I think you're right, and the Democratic Congress has given him what he wants because these are essential items. These essential items had to pass, and he has either vetoed them or threatened to veto them. Mm-hmm. While in the previous years, he hasn't vetoed anything. He vetoed one measure. And now, the use of the veto, they're saying, look, if we get anything through, we're going to have to either listen to the president or it's just not going to get through. The state child health proposal, for example, did not pass. He vetoed it. And right now, it's in limbo. In other words, they've extended it with temporary spending measures for a year, I guess it was. But the fact is that they have not passed the bill because the president and the Congress or the Democrats are on different wavelengths as to the percentage of income which would make you eligible for that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's an example. But a lot of the measures that got through were basically what the president wanted.
Next, we go to Don in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hi.
Morning.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Well, you know, I think we've gotten to the point where most of us want something for nothing. But my sense of it is that I'd like snow removed on a day like this. I'd like that service. I'd like to pay tax for it. But most of us are, you're paying taxes, but the businesses are getting away with, almost paying zero taxes. And I think that's the problem. I don't have a problem with the earmarks as such, but when it comes back to the states and they get to spend it, most of the tax breaks are given to the businesses, which almost pay no taxes, and it's the property taxes are going up for us. I think that's where we're missing the boat. Am I wrong?
What Don says is absolutely correct, is especially in the state of Wisconsin, because what has happened is on the measure of economic development, the argument is that we needed businesses here, we need to attract businesses here, and businesses threaten to leave. And so consequently, what we've done is we've given continuing exemptions to businesses, beginning with actually Governor Lucey with the M&E, and that's the machinery and inventory. M&E, machinery and
equipment.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. A little early in the morning. Machinery and equipment. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the property tax, you will see the shifting of the property tax from a more general base to the residential property tax. And that's what happened in Wisconsin, and it's happened in a number of other states. And the reason is very simple, and that is economic development, that we want more businesses here, we want to retain them here, they threaten to leave, and we're in competition with other states, which also are giving businesses things, and that was what is happening. The other side of the coin is the hope is that if businesses stay within the state of Wisconsin, more people will be employed, and therefore more taxes would be paid because they will be employed and they will be paying taxes, they will make more money and the like. But the actual shift, as Don mentions, has definitely occurred.
Yeah. Thanks, Don. Mark in Solon Springs. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, and I love your program.
Well, thanks for calling.
When 1978, I had a friend in Solon Springs. He had a Honda Civic that got 45 miles to the gallon. I had a 82 Dodge Colt that got 42 miles to the gallon. I own a 2001 Chevy Impala that gets 37 miles to the gallon, and that car today, that same car, only gets 26 miles to the gallon. So I'm wondering where this technology had gone. If we haven't got it now, what did they do with it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, not being automotive engineer, I can't tell you. But I do know that the that what Mark says is generally correct, that the fact is that the miles per gallon of the car, many of the cars, have not gone up very much. I mean, if they've gone up, they have not gone up very much. Of the whole fleet, though, what has happened is that they've gone down. And the reason that they've gone down for the whole fleet is that we've added more, like SUVs and those kinds of vehicles, that get less gas mileage. So even though maybe some individual cars have crept up, although Mark says they've gone down in some cases, but clearly they haven't gone up very much.
Yeah.
But the whole fleet, and that's the way they look at CAFE standards, the whole fleet has actually gone down because there's a shift in what people are buying.
Yeah, that number is the average.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Mark. Sharon in Baraboo. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. Last week on NPR, there was a news bleep about the Ohio electronic voting machines, which are, if you Google black box voting, that's the term they're using. And I didn't hear it on national news or any other mass media. And I remember the last elections, the issue came up about a month before the election. And I just think that this is the issue. I mean, we can be informed and make a choice to vote, but if our machinery and our electronic voting machines are not capable of taking our vote or can be manipulated, what is the issue that can be voted on if you can't vote?
Can you tell us, Professor?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what Sharon is talking about is been an issue because the argument is we needed to modernize our equipment. You know, that we vote with. And a lot of people were complaining about some of the, you know, some were using those punch card kind of things that they were using in Florida, and remember the hanging chads and things like that. And so what happened was people were saying, well, the modernized equipment is some of these touch screen ones. And so a lot of governments purchased these touch screens. Well, the problem with the touch screen one was that there was no paper record for these touch screen, and so therefore people are saying that they're inaccurate. There's some conflicting evidence of whether they're inaccurate or not, but clearly that there is no written record. And so what's happening in a number of governments right now is they're actually acting in this area, and what they're getting is different kinds of voting equipment in which there is a paper record. Well, a lot of them are spending a lot of money because they just bought all this equipment that was that they thought was fine. I don't think there's a conspiracy there. I think that they thought was fine. But in fact, now they question it, and there's great push that it must be with a paper record so that they can go back and check that particular paper. Remember the old lever machines? You know, when you pulled that machine, there was a paper record. I mean, not only did you get a total from that machine, but it also produced this paper record that they could go back and count the votes. Well, this is what people want from these electronic devices. But this has been a whole issue. Anytime you get electronic devices, this is an issue. Again, it creates problems, certainly in elections. Some people may, you know, anytime anything happens, somebody did it, you know, one side did it or the other side did it. But I think it's just simply this whole question of technology and what is the most accurate technology.
Let's talk about this. There's a big change in the government's rules on media ownership. The Federal Communications Commission last week voted to allow broadcasters in the nation's 20 largest media markets to also own a newspaper. The vote overturns a ban that's been in place for 32 years. The FCC's chair, Kevin Martin, and his two Republican colleagues voted in favor of the proposal. The commission's two Democrats voted against it. Martin has the support of the White House, which says it will turn back any congressional action that tries to undo this vote. So, how big a deal is this?
Well, this is important in terms of the media, and some people think it's very, very important in controlling, you know, what people see and hear, with the idea that the same station that owns the the network, will also, who owns the broadcast station, also owns the physical newspaper in that community. And this is this kind of concentration monopoly. Mm-hmm. It's a monopoly on not so much on economic power, although it may be that too, but not monopoly on people what people hear. On the other hand, the other side of the coin is that things have changed. In 2007, we no longer have just three stations coming in. They may be local stations, three local stations, but we have, you know, a whole bunch of stations on cable on, or on satellite. Plus, you've got tons of stations, including blogs on the internet. And so, consequently, the information source is radically different than it was when those rules were put in. And so one side argues things are radically different, that we have lots of different information. On the other side argues, no, this is still important, particularly for local news. Even though I can bring in, you know, a WGN from Chicago, in fact, is the local news is restricted to two or three stations, typically. Mm-hmm. And that's been the basic argument on media concentration. And, of course, underlying a lot of this is an economic issue for the stations.
Yeah. Our next caller is George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi.
Morning, George.
Yeah, I know that you had addressed to some extent the filibuster question before in terms of kind of laying out what the dilemma is for the Democrats, but I was impressed with an article that E.J. Dionne had written a few days ago in which he suggested that it probably would be to the Democrats' political benefit to take the Republicans to the mat and this kind of an issue, and show that the Republicans are really the ones who are holding up some of the legislation that the majority of the country says they want.
Yeah, like what, George?
Well, even taking something like the CHIPS, the children's issue of children's health care. Mm-hmm. You know, that they threatened filibuster on, or some of the things having to do with pullout from Iraq.
Yeah, Professor Miller?
Yeah, actually, S-CHIPS had passed. It was the mm-hmm. president that vetoed the S-CHIP bill. But, yeah, the Republicans are filibustering this. It's not as dramatic as it was before, and that may be one of the other issues, because in the old days, it kept the whole Senate from doing anything, and it was very dramatic. And on TV, often the news commentator was standing there with a clock or a calendar showing how many days the filibuster had taken place, and so there was great public pressure. Today, they've changed the Senate rules, and they use what's often called the track system. And so even though one bill may be filibustered, they then go on to other measures. And so the dramatic aspect showing that it's Republicans that are filibustering it isn't there. In the old days, it showed who was filibustering the bill, you know, who was standing up there speaking. Strom Thurmond was well known, you know, as a filibuster. Today, you don't hear that. The other thing, the other side of the filibuster related to the filibuster that is hardly ever heard of, I mean, you just don't hear it all, is the so-called holds. This is used in the Senate a lot, and this is where somebody puts a hold on a bill, basically saying they don't want the bill to come up at all. And those holds are holding up lots of legislation, and you never hear about it because it never gets on the Senate floor.
We're talking with Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point, recapping all the major news from Washington, D.C. over the past week. This is All Things Political. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Kathleen Dunn, awaiting your telephone call with the issue that's most important to you that you want to talk about, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. We've already talked about the energy bill that passed Congress and that President Bush signed last week, talked some about some of these budget bills and war funding bills and the alternative minimum tax and the child health care programs. We'll talk some coming up about the latest news from the presidential campaign trail as well, as that is dominating. It's not necessarily from Washington, D.C., but dominating some of the national political newscasts. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 10 o'clock, I'll talk with two guests about alternative gift ideas that will help support people, the planet, and combat world hunger. Some alternative gift-giving ideas on this Christmas Eve coming up after 10 o'clock. We're talking about the news from Washington, D.C., and across the country for that matter. It's all things political. Kathleen Dunn's regular Monday feature. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Kathleen Dunn, talking with Ed Miller, a professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point, about what our national lawmakers are up to in the past week. One thing we didn't talk about the last week, action continued on the CIA and those tapes that showed harsh interrogation, including waterboarding. I guess the CIA is going to start handing over documents to lawmakers who want to know about the CIA's destruction of those videotapes. They had threatened to subpoena the CIA to get this, and now the CIA is saying, "Okay, we'll you know release all this information." Where do you see this investigation going, Professor Miller? This issue going?
Well, I think the concern is there's many concerns. One concern is, was Congress informed? And now there's some debate about it. If Congress was informed about this, under the law, Congress must be informed. And the question whether there was a violation of the law there. The other one was, did it show actual torture, you know, and this is the whole question of waterboarding and so forth. And the third one, as you mentioned, in particular, what about the destruction of the tapes? Was this a violation of the law? It depends on, I think, maybe when they occurred. If they occurred before any request for the tapes, maybe it wasn't. On the other hand, if there was requests for the tapes, subpoenas of the tapes, like from the 9/11 Commission, which has said they had requested the tapes, then it becomes, you know, a violation of the law. And so consequently, some people could be charged in this area. The question is who, and how far did it go to the White House? Did the White House know about this? The opinion of some is that that the White House was asked, and White House counsel had said that it was okay to destroy the tapes.
Mm-hmm. Stan in New Glarus. Hi, Stan.
Can I get back on the old issue, or do you want me to talk about waterboarding?
You can talk about what you called in to talk about.
Okay. My heart bleeds for those people who are complaining about AMT. I thought they got their tax break 4 or 5 years ago from the president. I'd like to have you discuss the taxation of Social Security benefits, which came in the Reagan administration in 86. Our extra income that we have gets taxed up to 85% of our Social Security benefits, and I don't think that's fair.
Yeah, and you're relating that to the news of the week because of the alternative minimum tax?
Yeah, but I would love to talk about waterboarding because I served in the Philippine Islands in 1947-48. But go do the Social Security thing.
Yeah, I don't know if you have
that. The issue of Social Security and the taxation of Social Security has to do with two elements. And one element is that individuals receive Social Security, they pay into the system. It's a social insurance system. And so some people argue that if you pay into the system, you should receive money from that system that you've paid into. And remember that your Social Security that you've paid into that system has already been taxed. And so the money that you've put into the system has been taxed because it's post-tax money. However, the money in Social Security does earn an interest. And when you get that money back, the question is, should it then be taxed? For example, your pension. You pay into your pension system, which has already been taxed. But when you get the pension back, a certain amount of that, which is the earnings on that pension, are taxed. And the question is, what do you do with Social Security? At one time, no Social Security was taxed. But then, as Stan mentioned, in the Reagan administration, the decision was made that for more wealthy earners, people, I've forgotten how much it is, but how much you have to make over, but if you make over a certain amount, then some of the Social Security, I think it's 85% of Social Security, is taxed on those individuals. And the argument there is that, one, that the money that they're being taxed on has earned interest. It does earn interest, the amount of money you put into Social Security. And so you're getting back more money than you actually put in. Second is that they're wealthier taxpayers that are paying this, and the argument is that although, you know, poor individuals should not have to pay the tax, but those people who don't actually need the Social Security absolutely to live on a day-to-day basis should pay some of the tax. And the third argument that was done at that point in time was that Social Security system itself, to remain viable, needed the money. So that money does not go into the general taxation. That money goes back to the Social Security system. And so that's where that money goes. And so those are the arguments on both sides of the issue.
Thank you, Stan. We'll talk about waterboarding some other time. We're just reviewing all of the news of the week from Washington. So that's why we're skipping from issue to issue. We're not on just one topic all hour long. Joy in Eau Claire, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question is the all the problems that we're seeing with the economic growth, is it in any way related to the fact that George Bush's administration early on made filing for bankruptcy so much more difficult?
Any thoughts on that?
That economic growth is related to...
Well, no, I mean, all the problems that we're hearing about people and not meeting their bills and all these issues that, you know, over and over, it seems like it's really increased. And yes, I agree, the economy, but I also know that a lot of people before were able to claim bankruptcy.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of people having problems with their home mortgages because of this meltdown. But,
The home mortgages, and I don't think that would have much to do with the bankruptcy. But it is more difficult to declare bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. There was a change in that, and that has to do more with It has less to do with mortgages and more to do with credit cards.
Right.
And with the mortgages situation, what that was a number of things. One was the issuing of subprime mortgages or mortgages to individuals that had less than the best credit worthiness. And then the second thing has to do with what they did with those mortgages, that rather than those mortgages being held by the bank and maybe sold to organizations such as Fannie Mae, what they were doing is then bundling those mortgages and then selling them as financial instruments, which then traded, which we often call derivatives, meaning that they traded themselves, but were derived from the mortgages that underlied them. Well, if those mortgages, though, go bad, then these financial instruments that are sold go bad, and that's what's causing the problem right now in the financial markets.
Yeah. The president did give a couple of speeches last week, kind of, sort of, trying to reassure us about the economy, saying that the underpinnings are, you know, are pretty good and that we have seen job growth and our economy has been growing since 2001. But there are some storm clouds on the horizon, including this housing problem and the credit crunch. One thing he said was that Congress should not raise taxes. That would be the worst thing to do during a time like this. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because on one hand, the economy is doing well, and the other thing that he says, on the other hand, he says they shouldn't raise taxes. Normally, you don't raise taxes in a recession situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he's not expecting a recession, then we may get an inflation, then you do raise taxes. So those were somewhat inconsistent. But I think that if you look at the economy isn't doing too badly if you look at the growth statistics on it. However, since we hadn't mentioned the election yet, I should just point out, interestingly enough, all the surveys have shown that concerns about the economy have risen massively among people in the election as their priorities and their concerns.
Yeah. Let's see if we have... Yeah, Steve in Boulder Junction has been waiting. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good
morning, Steve.
Hi. Professor, I noticed with interest your comments on the energy bill, and the ethanol comments are great, because I think that the corn-based ethanol is incredibly inefficient. And my wife owns a farm in central Illinois, so, yeah, corn prices are up, but so are fertilizer prices and production prices. So it's not quite a zero-sum game, but it's not a terribly attractive one. And for the rest of the consumers, it's a particularly unattractive one. But the thing I focused on was you said, well, there's a lot of emphasis on wind power as well. But where I'd like your comment is that it was the interesting evisceration of the energy bill with respect to wind power and geothermal, whereby President Bush opposed the last version of the Senate bill, which had a surtax, if you will, on the corporate tax on the integrated major oil company profits, which would have provided a transfer tax to subsidize investment in wind power and geothermal, the latter of which is kind of irrelevant because it, you know, it only applies to the volcanic and earthquake-prone areas of the U.S., and Chevron, in effect, dominates that anyway. But any, and they're all capital-intensive. But on wind power, that's really quite important.
Yeah.
He thought it was an unfair tax. And so the perspective on Congress, in effect, saying, okay, we're going to throw out wind power subsidies just to get this thing through, is, you know, I mean, I'm neither naive or cynical. I guess that makes me a realist, which means I'm somewhat cynical, of course. But I'd really appreciate your perspective on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are two elements to it. One is, quite clearly, they have been opposed to any tax, and so they've been opposed to any tax, whether it's on individuals or on big oil companies. And so they've opposed the tax and then the other argument that he mentions, and that's true. A lot of people have criticized the energy bill for giving insufficient attention to the various alternative energy kinds of things, such as wind power.
Yeah.
That's clearly been understated in the bill. But there is some money there, but it's pretty small.
Let's talk a little bit about news from the campaign trail, the presidential campaign trail. Iowa caucuses coming up in, 10 days or less?
Right.
I don't know. How do you see this thing shaping up first on the Democratic side?
Well, on the Democratic side, it's an interesting one because the latest Globe poll shows Obama ahead. And so he's slightly ahead of Hillary Clinton. It's a very difficult situation, even to judge, because the Iowa caucuses are so convoluted, you know, it's so difficult, particularly in the Democratic side, whereby if you don't have sufficient numbers, you can convince some to join your group or join the other group and so forth. So it gets very confusing. But quite clearly, the two leaders, and the question is whether Obama and Clinton, it's not even who wins. It's whether they come close to one another. Because if one knocks out the other, that could have significant rebounding effects for the subsequent primaries because they come so soon after that. I think quite clearly those are the two. Edwards is hoping that they basically knock each other out and that he moves up as considered the compromise choice.
Yeah. I saw another poll just out, too, though, that showed Hillary Clinton's lead in New Hampshire had also diminished or even dissolved. And it looks like, at least in those first two states, there's a lot more people thinking new ideas rather than same old experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think people are looking for new ideas. And I think that's not unusual. You can just look at Clinton's election. I mean, he was considered Bill Clinton's election. He was considered new ideas. He was governor, was not involved in Washington, or Carter as well. And so people are always looking for new ideas. But then the question is experience. Hillary Clinton is considered much more experienced than Barack Obama. But interestingly enough, the really experienced candidates, the ones that really have a lot of experience...
Yeah, they're way down there.
Right. They're also runs here. They call them Joe Biden. Quite clearly, lots of experience. You know, Chris Dodd and Bill Richardson. They're not even in the... nearly the top.
All right, so let's look at the GOP side. Mike Huckabee is just still continuing to fly high here.
He is strong. He's come up basically from nowhere. Although in Iowa right now, I still think Romney may be important. You know, in that contest, quite clearly. But Huckabee has come up, and clearly he has appealed to the conservative elements of the party. And there's been some controversy over his recent commercial.
His Christmas card with the cross of the bookcase behind him.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And then is the argument that, you know, Christ needs to be put back into Christmas. But the fact is that that's typically a separation of politics and religion, which may do well in Iowa, but it may not do well nationally.
Yeah. Well, we only have a minute to go. Professor Miller, anything else as we close out this holiday week and look ahead?
Well, certainly we're going to see a lot of other things. I mean, we're going to see things in international, what's going to happen in the Iraq. I mean, we do have the surge, but something is going to happen there. What are we going to do? Are we going to withdraw or some of the troops anyway? And the political issues by the Iraqi government. And clearly, you can't ever leave out the Middle East. We had the Annapolis Conference, which is pretty much an agreement to talk, to follow the so-called roadmap, if there is a roadmap. But what is the role of Hamas? What about Israeli security? Issues of Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem they're talking about now, and so forth. So the Middle East will be a clear one that we'll look at for the new year.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW Stevens Point. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.